Welcome to Abound in Hope, a podcast from Imprint Church. Our goal is to help you apply the hope of the gospel of Jesus Christ to everyday life. We are back this week with another session from the Gospel and Mental Health. This is the second session from Dr. Kevin Van Lant, from when he came and visited us in March of this year. Without further ado, here's Dr. Van Lant.
I was a little cheeky about, you know, telling pastors to be quiet. The goal isn't for them to stay quiet. The goal is for them to be quiet long enough to get enough context of the person's story to know how to speak into it with wisdom and with God's wisdom. So I don't want you to think the whole idea is just be quiet and then it's over and you leave. Definitely not the case. So we're going to shift gears a little bit and talk about finding purpose and meaning in pain and suffering, which sounds dreary as I look at that, but I actually don't believe it is. And part of the reason I don't believe it is kind of going back to what we were talking about a little earlier, which is, we're all going to suffer. Some of us suffer more than others, but this is something we're all going to go through. And so what do we do with it? Like, how do we make sense of it, and how do we move through it with some hope? And so my time here, I'm hoping, will be hopeful. So we'll see where this goes. This psalm will not start out hopeful. This psalm will not start out hopeful. It will end hopeful, but it doesn't start out that way. Psalm 77, 1 verses 12, or 1 through 12. I yell out to God. I yell with all my might. I yell at the top of my lungs. He listens. I found myself in trouble and went looking for my Lord. My life was an open wound that wouldn't heal. When friends said, everything will turn out all right, I didn't believe a word they said. I remember God and shake my head. I bow my head and wring my hands. I'm awake all night, not a wink of sleep. Some of you can relate to this. I can't even say what's bothering me. I go over the days one by one. I ponder the years gone by. I strum my lute all through the night, wondering how to get my life together. Will the Lord walk off and leave us for good? Will he never smile again? Is his love worn threadbare? Has his salvation promise burned out? Has God forgotten his manners? I love that line. Has he angrily stomped off and left us? Just my luck, I said. The high God retires just the moment I need him. Once again, I'll go over what God has done, lay out on the table the ancient wonders. I'll ponder all the things you've accomplished and give a long, loving look at your acts. You guys can relate to this, right? Right? This was written how many thousands of years ago? A few, at least, right? This was written a very long time ago. And the writer of this psalm, I think, is writing something that some of us can really relate to because we've lived it. We've lived it through. And I again want to bring us back to Scripture, because Scripture is not, it's not revelation that God gives us that somehow is sort of neutrally immune to suffering. There's suffering all throughout it. So we have a God who suffers. One of the preeminent philosophers on the problem of evil, his name is Alvin Plantinga. If any of you are familiar with Alvin Plantinga, I went to hear him speak a couple of times. When he speaks, I can't understand hardly what he's saying, because at some point philosophy starts to sound like math. And it just, I don't know if you've ever noticed that. Brilliant guy. And he's spent his entire career talking about the problem of evil. And one thing he says, what he said at this conference I was at, he said, you know, at the end of the day, the only thing that makes sense to me about the problem of evil is that we have a God who suffered with us. That Jesus came to earth and he knows suffering because he suffered here. He's not immune from it. And so as we go through Scripture, it's pretty evident that God understands this, and the writers of some of these understand it as well. Walter Brueggemann, I'm not a Brueggemann sort of scholar, so I enjoy him. But he writes this about the psalm. This hope is rooted precisely in the midst of loss and darkness, where God is surprisingly present. The Jewish reality of exile, the Christian confession of crucifixion and cross, the honest recognition that there's an untamed darkness in our life that must be embraced. All of that is fundamental to the gift of new life. And Brueggemann is kind of saying something that I know as a therapist when I sit with patients that I work with, is that the gift of new life starts with pain. It always starts with pain. And those of you who are mothers in this room, you know that the gift of new life started with some pain. And there is hope in that pain. And so when we're thinking about what's our untamed darkness, right? Where's God? Where might he be working that? I wanted to just spend a few minutes sort of sharing a little bit of my own story, just because I think contextually when we talk about the rest of the content tonight, it might help make sense. But in a nutshell, I didn't become a clinical psychologist just by chance. In fact, I don't know anybody that does clinical work that just started doing it by chance. They all started doing it, I think, in a way to kind of make sense of something that painful that happened in their own lives. That's been most of my experience. And when I was much, much younger, I met my first wife in seventh grade algebra class. And she didn't really like me that much, but I met her in seventh grade algebra class, and we became friends over the years, and she was a Christian, and I was raised in a Christian home, but it was a little dry. And we became friends, and I think I wasn't really dating material because I was a bit of a wild man, and I don't think she quite wanted to deal with that. And she went to a church, had a really wonderful youth ministry, and kept inviting me. Eventually, I went and just loved it. And and then I think I became dating material at that point in time. So we started dating and got married pretty young, in our very early 20s. I was working for the telephone company, climbing telephone poles when I was like 18, 19 years old. I loved it, by the way. When you're 18 and 19 and you're like a monkey, it's super fun. I didn't want to do it the rest of my life, but it was fun at the time. My wife was working at Disneyland, and we got married, and things were going well. She became pregnant when she was 23. Neither of us were ready to have to be parents, and I know how people get pregnant, but she wasn't supposed to get pregnant. And it was rough at first because she really wasn't ready to be a mom. Eventually, that kind of changed, and we both became excited about being a parent. And when she was 8 months pregnant, and I was there when it happened, but she had something called an amniotic embolism. And essentially, that means the amniotic fluid around the baby leaked into her bloodstream and more or less had a heart attack. No one knew what was happening, and paramedics came and did CPR on her for hours and hours and hours. And we end up at the hospital in the ER. I show up. I'm there, in the ER waiting room. And the room starts slowly filling up with family and friends and our pastor, and it's obviously becoming very unlikely that she's going to survive. And at one point, the ER surgeon, who I can still picture her, she was this angelic-looking female ER doc. Like, she literally looked like an angel. She just had the softest presence. It was just sweet. And she says to me, you know, Kevin, we've been doing CPR for a long time, and we did an ECG on her brain, and there's no brain function, and we need your permission to stop life support. So I'm like 24 and completely ill-prepared for any of this. And so I turned to my pastor at the time, and I'm like, John, what do I do, you know? And he says, well, why don't we ask them to do one more ECG? So they do one more ECG. And again, no brain activity. And so we withdraw life support, and she dies, the baby dies. I mean, they were both passed away by that point. And, you know, my life just sort of stopped at that point. I remember my brother driving me to my parents' house, and it was so bizarre that the world was still turning. I remember this still so clearly, that there were obviously people driving to work and to the store and to wherever they were going, and it just seemed so wrong. It seemed like the whole world should have gone on pause at that moment. And that started a really long journey. And at times I was probably more gracious than not. At times I was pretty depressed. At times I felt like that guy that would sit in my office and say, you know, what's the point? It just didn't feel like there was much of a point. And God was taking me on this really difficult journey through my own untamed darkness at that point in time. And part of what I'm going to talk about tonight is a little bit based on my own experiences, but frankly, it's really based on that plus, like, countless people that I've seen in therapy over the years. I don't even know how many people I've seen in therapy. I completely lost track. But they've taught me so much. They've taught me so much about suffering. And they've taught me so much about what it looks like to move through suffering and to endure it. And what I really want to talk about for the rest of the evening is how do we, because when people are experiencing mental illness, they're suffering. And it can feel like it's hopeless. It can feel like it's pointless. It can feel like all of these different things. And what do we do kind of in those moments with them? So what I want to talk about a little bit is sort of what I kind of think of as like there's 10 things, but the attributes of those who seem to find purpose and meaning in their journey through pain. And that's really where I want to go. And I think it's relevant to virtually every area of mental illness, by the way. Brueggemann kind of talks about orientation, disorientation, reorientation. He really thinks that there are psalms that are all about orientation to God. And then he references a lot of psalms that are all about disorientation, that really are just, it's David just angry and frustrated and, you know, belligerent and whatever else he is. And then the psalms that are about reorientation, right? How do we then become reoriented back to God? And I think that sort of description of orientation, disorientation, reorientation is part of that journey through pain, because I don't think we get there without the disorientation. And disorientation is really scary and confusing. I don't know if you remember that movie Gravity, when Sandra Bullock gets like launched out of that capsule, whatever it is, and she's just spinning through space. Did you ever see that movie? And she's just like spinning through space because there's no gravity, there's no like friction. And I just think to myself, oh my gosh, that would be like the worst way to die. I would just hate it. It would just be terrible. But that's that disorientation that I mean. Like, we're just having a hard time knowing what up is up when down is down and left is left and whatnot. So this is just kind of where I want to go, and take this for what it's worth. And there's no particular order to this, so it's not like one is more important than 10. But number one here, they're aware of and accept the fact that life is difficult. and that God can be found in the darkness. So the writer of Psalm 77 is clearly acknowledging that life is difficult, certainly can be difficult. And then he transitions to that later stage of the psalm, and I didn't include the whole psalm, but he makes that transition back to reorientation and that God can be found in that darkness. The darkness didn't go away, but he became more aware of God's promises in the midst of that. And my thought about this is that most of us think that life should be easier than it is. Like, we really do. I don't blame you for it. I think it should be easier than it is. I think we all think it should be easier than it is. I ask my students about this oftentimes, like, why do you think y'all think life should be so much easier than it ends up being for you? I think part of it is because it's so hard to live in that. Like, it's so hard to just, like, sit in that reality that, you know, yeah, today is great, but boy, who knows what's going to happen tomorrow, right? Who wants to live there? But I do think that there is something about this that becomes fundamental because, I mean, if you've read, it's like an oldie but a goodie, but The Road Less Traveled. Remember the opening line in The Road Less Traveled? Life is difficult. And the sooner we get over the fact and accept that fact, the sooner we can kind of grow up and become adults, right? And kind of let go of that kind of childish idea that life is just going to be smooth for us. And I think at some point in time, those who sort of find their way through this journey of pain, they make space for that reality. They make space for that reality that, yeah, life is going to be hard. And all of you have been through hard things. And there's no promise that it's not going to be hard tomorrow. And so what does it look like for us to sort of live into that, I think, a little more deeply and kind of imagine that God can sort of be found in the midst of that darkness? That's not an overnight process. I'll talk about that in a moment. That's a hard-earned reality. But I think it's a place that we do have to start. Number two, they don't overly personalize their suffering, which I know sounds a little weird because on some level, all suffering is personal. When you're going through something that's painful, that's your pain, and it's real, and it's personal to you. I think where it goes a little haywire sometimes is when we move into this territory where it begins to feel like God is doing this to me. You know, for the secular person, you know, the universe is doing this to me, right? It becomes this experience of this is happening to me for some specific reason because something or someone wants to punish me for something. And I have so many people that come to see me who are in the midst of the suffering, and they kind of view God that way. That's sort of their experience of God. And they come in feeling guilty. They feel ashamed because they're carrying this idea that God is sort of taking his finger and said, okay, boom, you are going to have to go through this hell. Right? I don't think that's biblical. I don't think that's the heart of God. I think it goes back to that Romans 8 passage that we talked about a little earlier, which is creation is broken. You're broken. The world's broken. And that brokenness is going to affect us one way or the other, either directly or indirectly, but that brokenness is going to affect us. And so this idea of not personalizing it, I think leaves a little more room to kind of wonder, what is God doing in the midst of this? What am I doing in the midst of this? And how do I find a place for this in my own heart, my own life? And I do think it sort of shifts this conceptualization of God. Number three, they remember rightly. Remember rightly. So back to that passage again, will the Lord walk off and leave us for good? Will he never smile again? Is his love worn threadbare and so on? And then he gets to verse 11 and 12. And then once again, I go over what God has done. I lay out on the table the ancient wonders. I ponder all the things you've accomplished and give you a long, loving look at your acts. This idea of remembering rightly, I actually think is really kind of key, because we have a human tendency to distort reality. We really do. I can't tell you how many people I've seen in therapy over the years who they're in abusive relationships. They finally sort of get the strength internally to kind of break free from the abusive spouse or the abusive boyfriend or whatever, and they're away from them for 2 or 3 months. And then what happens? They go back, or they want to go back. And it's hard for them to remember what it was really like. In psychology, we call that the negative affect bias. And the negative affect bias is just jargon for, over time, we begin to forget the negative. And we begin to misremember kind of what reality was like. I think it actually works in the opposite direction, too. I think sometimes we can have that affect bias in the opposite direction, and we can remember things maybe more negatively than what they were as well. But remembering rightly in this context, I think, really is this idea of how do we sort of internalize and hold on to the full reality of what was going on instead of picking and choosing the parts that we really want to hold on to. I had someone recently was just lamenting, and it was true, sad. It was true. I mean, they were talking about how sad they were that their extended family was just not. They have extended family, but it's just such a dangerous, toxic brew of people that over the years, this person has really worked very hard to remove themselves from. And as they were talking to me recently, I had to kind of go back and remind this person of all of the reasons why it had been so destructive for them to be with these family members. Now, I want people to have connection with family. It's not that I'm trying to, you know, dismantle families, but it was more, this was so destructive and the need was so great that they were misremembering. They weren't remembering accurately what was going on. So I think it's important for us to sort of remember what's real. I notice this a lot at funerals. I don't know if you've ever gone to a funeral. And I know we don't want to say, you know, bad things about the deceased. But sometimes you go to a funeral and you're like, I don't remember that person. That's a whole different animal. But I do think it's important for us to remember rightly, because I think in the context of remembering rightly, we remember God's place in it all more accurately too. We remember God's provision in it all more accurately as well. And we remember how people have kind of walked with us through things more accurately. And so there's something about staying in reality that is key. And I am a big believer in reality. Reality is our friend. And when people go off the rails, it's usually because they're avoiding reality. They're avoiding some aspect of it that's either painful or will be painful or is confusing or it hurts. And I get it. I don't want to hurt either. But in the end, I don't quote Carl Jung at church very often. although he did study in divinity school for a little while. So, but Carl Jung, he talks about this idea of, I'll quote him. He says, most people's psychological problems, now this is not fully accurate because remember, he's a product of his time. It was like 100 years ago. We didn't understand neurobiology. We didn't understand the role of medications. We didn't understand kind of what goes wrong. So take it in the context that he said it. But he said, most people's psychological problems are the result of avoiding legitimate suffering. It's in the moving toward and internalizing and accepting legitimate suffering that we heal. Because if you have a wound on your arm and you really need an antibiotic and all you're doing is like pouring water on it or something, you're not going to heal that thing. Like you had to suffer legitimately. It's still going to hurt, but it's not legitimate pain. And legitimate pain oftentimes leads to some type of healing. Now, healing may not be, I feel all better, but something kind of in the realm of healing might look more like, I'm more grounded, I'm clear about what's happening in my life, and I can make decisions based upon that, not upon the stuff that's not real. So they hold the good-bad tension and don't expect their situation to immediately or perhaps even fully resolve. And the good-bad tension, that's based in a lot of theory that I won't go into, but the good-bad tension in a nutshell is this. Everything's a mixed bag. Everything's a mixed bag. It doesn't matter what it is. That person that you fell in love with, that you idealized, and you thought they walked on water, and then a year into marriage, you're like, you do that, and you do that. Like we live in a fallen world, and nothing is perfect. Nothing's perfect on this planet. And the reason I'm kind of bringing this up is that when we kind of accept that reality, we can kind of live with the tension of it better. That this person we love is also at times the person that we hate. Right? I won't ask you to share stories. Right? But that is part of our reality. And any of you who have spent any time on this planet know it's true. It's just hard to admit. Sometimes just hard to admit. It's not hard for my wife to admit. She's like, no, I'm joking about that. But, and I love this passage in Ecclesiastes. Consider the work of God, right? I think I'm missing a word there. Who can straighten what God has bent? In the day of prosperity, be joyful, but in the day of adversity, consider this. God made one of these along with the other. There's another passage in Ecclesiastes where he says, rain falls upon the just and the unjust alike. That's what we get. Sometimes bad people get some nice rain that feeds their crop. And sometimes good people don't. Sometimes things are bent. And who can really fix it? And I think about this relative to my own experience. Like, I am blessed. I've had just a wonderful wife. And three boys that I just adore. I feel half the time like I am the most fortunate guy that ever walked this planet. Like, I'm not just saying that, like, I really do. I just pinch myself sometimes. I think, I can't believe you have this life. And it's not because there hasn't been a lot of junk, because there has been a lot of junk. But I say this for this reason, kind of like with Job. You know, when Job lost everything, his kids, not his wife that told him to curse God and die, but the right, his livestock, his crops, his health, his well-being, like he loses it all. And then at the end, what happens? God restores this, right? Gives him more children and more livestock and more farmland. And is that the message? Is that the story? I don't think so, right? Like, I love my wife, I love my boys, but they didn't replace my first wife and son. Like, I still lament the loss of my wife and son. I still, every year, remember how old he would have been, right? They didn't replace who I have now. And I say this because sometimes things aren't going to resolve. Even though I really love my life and I love my wife and I love my kids, it didn't fully resolve. Like, those losses are just still losses. They're not replaced. And I think those who move through this journey of pain find a way to make some peace with that. And I think maybe the next few slides might help with that a bit, but I do think it's a fundamental piece to this. They allow themselves time and space to grieve and lament. You know, I studied under one of the top grief therapists in the country. I was very fortunate. And I feel like, you know, it was instrumental in terms of being able to sort of do grief therapy. But one thing that I kind of realized, this wasn't rocket science, but realized is that grief takes time. It never happens quickly. It never happens predictably. And everybody's grief is a little different. And we're horrible grievers. Like, we really, I don't know what it is about Americans. We don't like to grieve. We like to move on, right? Okay, that stage is done and let's go. And I see so many people come in and, you know, they're either just getting out of a long-term relationship or they're getting a divorce. And no matter how many times I'll tell them, just be single for a little while. Just grieve the loss of that relationship. Make sense of what happened to you. Let yourself feel it and sort of move that process of loss and let go. I swear 3/4 of them are in a relationship the next day. And I think it's partially because of like the apps, like swipe right or left. I don't even know which way you swipe. But they just get into a relationship like moment later and then that crashes and burns and they're like, oh, Dr. Van Lan, I know, I shouldn't have done that. And then they will do the same exact thing again. And it's amazing how much money people pay me and don't listen to me. That's the... And I, you know, I just love them through it. You know, it's like, okay, it's like your kids, right? You just know it's going to happen again. Like, okay, well, here, we'll walk through this another time. It'll take eventually. That's the thing. But this Romans 5 passage I just love, and this is only half of it. The next half is on the next page, but I didn't want to put it all here. But we also glory in our sufferings, which is an interesting statement because none of us want to suffer. And I don't think God is a sadist. So there's something about this notion of glory, finding glory in our sufferings that we'll maybe talk about another time. Maybe if you guys have me back up, we can talk about another time. But because we know that suffering produces perseverance, right? Some versions of scripture call it endurance. I kind of like both. So suffering produces endurance. And then perseverance, character, and character, hope. And hope does not put us to shame because God's love has been poured out into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given to us. That's the sequence. We don't get to jump from here, right, from suffering to hope. We just don't get to do that. We have to grieve. We have to endure. We've got to suffer a bit. We've got to grieve and lament because what's the role of grief? You ever think about that? Like, what? Why do we grieve? Like, why is grieving actually an important thing for us to do? I could wait, but, you know, grief gives us the opportunity to let go of the person or thing or hope or wish or fantasy. It allows us to let go of the thing that's lost. That's grief's job. And if we don't grieve, we don't even really recognize what it is we've lost. We're not spending enough time to even consider what its role was in our life or what that person's role was in our life. And so we have to. And this point number 6, and this is, you know, as a therapist, like when I get to this place with people, you know, I just want to jump up and down and, you know, clap, right? We get to a place where we embrace how the pain may be creating a deeper, better self. I would not ever want to go through the loss that I went through. And the people I work with, they would never want to go through some of the pain and losses that they've gone through. But if I'm honest, I like what it did to me. I like this sort of long game of how God used that grief and how God used people in my life, how God himself worked in my life. I wouldn't trade it for the world. Like, I really wouldn't. Even though I don't like the idea that that came at the cost that it came at, because I would never want to pay that cost. And so there is something about being able to, without guilt and without shame and without embarrassment and without having to figure it all out, because we're talking now about like quantum physics or something, I don't know. We're talking about something that feels so big to me, this idea that somehow God can do a work in our lives, and in the end, we so appreciate how he has kind of improved us, right? St. Augustine talks about this, he uses this phrase, like the same shaking that makes fetid water, like stale water, produce the stench. It's the same shaking that makes perfume produce some more fragrant aroma, right? It's the shaking, it's the movement. But when you're in the beginning of this, this doesn't make any sense. And if you try to get somebody there prematurely, they'll just want to hit you. I mean that, like you can't get ahead of this with people. You've just got to walk with them through it, and you've got to be patient. And it's ugly, and it's messy, and it's scary, and it's confusing, and it hurts you, and you don't want to be in it sometimes either because it's hard. But that's what you do when you sit with people. That's part of the work. Okay, they pursue connection with God and bring their suffering into relationship with God. God is near to the brokenhearted. So Psalm 77, Psalm 34, there's a lot of references to this. And I think this becomes messy because a lot of times, as someone whose son died in a car accident, my word, she was angry at God. Like, she was just furious at God. Now, she has a bit of an anger problem anyway, so I'll put that into context. But she needed me to be able to endure that anger so that she could eventually move to a place of realizing that this is a longer story, but that God suffers too, that God, this was not God's desire for her to lose her son. And it's probably a bad one to lead off with because it would take so much time to make more sense of it. But this idea of really pursuing God ultimately may not be in the beginning, but I think ultimately. They have meaningful connection with others. They have a community. I mentioned this a little bit in the previous presentation, but we're not good alone. We get weird alone. We kind of do, right? We kind of do. I don't mean being single. I mean being alone. And over time, you know, COVID made us a little cuckoo. People were doing the weirdest things. You ever notice that? The stuff that was coming out online is like, you need somebody to come and talk to you. So, but I do think, you know, AA has all these great sayings, and I love this saying, pain shared is pain lessened. Pain shared is pain lessened. There is something about meaningful connection to others that I think really is one of the most fundamental aspects of emotional and psychological health. And it's difficult, though, because when we're really depressed, when we're really traumatized, when we're really just dealing with some deep sorrow, we don't really want to be around people. Do you ever try to get somebody who's depressed to go and do something with you? They don't want to, which I get. Like, I get why they don't want to. I understand that. But the hard part is, how do you continue to keep inviting them? And my encouragement is, if you have somebody in your kind of community or your circle who you know is kind of depressed, and every time you call them and say, hey, let's go get coffee, let's go to the movie, let's go bowling or play a round of golf or whatever it is, and they keep saying no, you keep calling. Because at some point, they're going to say yes. They're just not ready to say yes yet. And the difficulty is that most people stop calling. Like, we don't like to be rejected too many times. Eventually, we kind of give up. but I do think it's important for you to try to stay in the hunt. Depressive symptoms are common among those who are lonely or isolated during such times, which is pretty obvious. There are many times I had a very, very close childhood friend of mine named John who, after my first wife passed away, and he and my first wife were really, they were pals, and after she passed away, he moved in with me and lived in that house with me for probably 2.5 years till he got married. And there are times when I think that actually saved my life. And I'm not saying that flippantly. Like, I think he really did. So if he ever watches this video, you know, thank you, John. I've told him that. Number 9, they redeem some of their pain by coming alongside someone else who's going through hard times. I love this passage from Corinthians 1:3-4. All praise to the God and Father of our Master Jesus the Messiah, Father of all mercy, God of all healing counsel. He comes alongside us when we go through hard times, and before you know it, this is from The Message, which I love how Eugene Peterson says things, and before you know it, he brings us alongside someone else who's going through hard times so that we can be there for that person just as God was there for us. This is interesting, but I think in the end, we have to find a way to redeem our pain. It doesn't mean undoing it, because we can't undo it, but we need to do something useful with it. And when I ended up, you know, deciding to go to graduate school to be a psychologist, that was not something that earlier in my life I'd ever planned to do. Part of what drove that train for me is I had to find a way to redeem my pain. I had to find a way to use what I had gone through to come alongside others and try to be salt and light to them in a meaningful way. I grew up in the Reformed tradition, right? And so I had to go to catechism when I was a kid. I don't still go to Reformed church, but I went to catechism, and I loved one of the catechisms, which is our role here is to participate with God in the redemption of creation. I don't remember much from catechism because I hated going. Oh my gosh, every Saturday morning, I just hated it. But I remember that one, and for some reason, all that I forgot, God left that one in there. And as an adult, that is sort of just one of my favorite notions, is both in my work in psychology, my work teaching, is how do we come alongside and participate with God in redeeming creation? And that's going to look like a lot of different things, from picking up trash on the side of the road to sitting with someone who is suffering, because they're his creation too. So I feel like time is... I'll go last here quickly. They find hope in their belief that God will ultimately redeem all creation. This passage from Colossians, I just find hope in these kinds of passages personally. Not only that, but all the broken and dislocated pieces of the universe. Right? How broad is that? People and things, animals and atoms get properly fixed and fit together in vibrant harmonies, all because of his death, Jesus' death. His blood that poured down from the cross. The arc of Scripture is an arc of redemption. From Adam and Eve to the end of Revelation, it's a story of God redeeming his people, redeeming us. And you get to participate in that. And this ministry that, is it Mary? I'm sorry. Yeah. I love what you guys are doing. Because you get to bring people in these very real ways to participate in redeeming them. So bless you.
Thanks for listening. For more resources and information about Imprint Church in general, you can head to imprintchurch.org. But if you want more information about what Dr. Vanlant was talking about with mental health resources, particularly with hope coaching, you can head to imprintchurch.org/mental health, or you can go to imprintchurch.org/hope if you would like to speak with a hope coach. We'll see you soon.